Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. The lack of progress on immigration reform has frustrated many, especially the so-called Dreamers, the children of undocumented immigrants who have lived here in the United States most of their lives. Earlier this summer, a group of these young people decided to cross the U.S.-Mexico border voluntarily to bring attention to the issue. One of those activists, Marco Saavedra, joins us now in the studio. His exhibit, Shadows Then Light, The Struggle of Undocumented Youth for Immigrant Justice, opens on October 10th at the Ease Gallery. For more information, you can visit the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Marco, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You are a poet and an artist, and I want to get to your art in a little while. But first of all, I wanted to talk about what you went through in July. You were among a group of 9 undocumented youth who deliberately crossed the southern border into the United States to protest current policy and as an act of resistance to the deportation system. Can you be more specific as far as the distinction between the current policy and the deportation system issue?
Yeah. So I think a frustration of ours as immigrant youth activists, as folks involved in the immigrant justice struggle, is that under the current Obama administration, we've seen minor reforms like deferred action for childhood arrivals or memorandums outlining discretion on who should be detained and deported. But at the same time, in concrete reality, we've never seen as many deportations historically, and we've never seen as many people detained, an average of 1,000 people are deported every day, and every day at least 33,000 people are in immigrant detention at the cost of $169 on average per person. And half of those facilities are privately run. So I think it has become an entire industry in and of itself and has taken an amazing toll on our families, resulting in about easily 1.5 million deportations over the last 6 years under the current administration.
You first had to cross over into Mexico because you grew up pretty much in the United States. You've been here since you were
three.
And what inspired you to take that risk? It was a big risk for you.
Yes.
And why was it important for you to be part of that group?
Yeah. Well, again, I think it was a pressure of the moment, of the times, knowing that as immigrant youth involved in the struggle for the past 2 years, fighting each deportation of a family or friend, one that we can with minimum capacity, and at the same time seeing that for every one victory that we won, we lost 1,000 folks in our community. And so we wanted to highlight that. I mean, obviously, we had to go back to the people that are deemed very much expendable, even when we talk about immigration reform deportees, and how to bring those folks back, even absent reform, which is kind of the situation that we're faced with now. And at the same time, at the personal level, being in the United States for 20 years and not being able to see the Mexican side of my family for 2 decades also takes a toll. And it also takes a toll that we see increasingly more and more border enforcement, to the effect that if my grandfather ever wants to visit us due to like our poverty and lack of political access, he has to cross through the border even at the age of 65 as an elderly man. And so I think there's all of these dynamics playing out that led to this decision.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with artist, activist Marco Saavedra. He has a show opening coming up in October 10th. If you want to know more about that, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Marco, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the pros and cons of immigration reform, or maybe a better way to put it is we're going to take a look at two different points of view on immigration reform, people, some wanting to ease the restrictions and others wanting to tighten the restrictions. Both require reforms either way. Some have said that the act of activism, that particular act, has upset the teacups, I guess, in Washington, where Republicans are at work on a variety of issues, albeit in separate bills and differently than they managed it in the Senate with the Gang of Eight, that it didn't do any good.
I think our only response to the criticism of our work as to whether we stirred the pot even further is that the heat of the oppression in our communities is already intolerable. The amount of depression, detention, deportations. And I think it already speaks to our condition where we're battling between a worse option or a worser option. And I think absent reform and absent relief, I think it, to me at least, it's entirely logical that undocumented youth would take it upon themselves to to take up again arms against the Sea of Troubles, to quote Hamlet. I think in very sharp defiance, and I think that the gears are so much against our favor that it takes place in a very discomforting way, and discomforting to the institution, because to us, I mean, I think our very much existence is always almost intolerable.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but 7 of the 9 had already been deported.
Correct.
Right. So they're
6 of the 9, yes.
6 of the 9, okay. And you, all 9 of you, spent 15 days in Arizona in a private detention facility.
Correct.
Can you tell us what that's like, what it was?
Yeah, look, the Eloy Detention Facility is a privately run facility by the Corrections Corporation of America. And the only way I can really explain it to people is that growing up undocumented with that fear of being deported at any moment or losing a family member at any moment to deportation takes a very real toll on you, your emotions, and obviously I think manifested itself to me like in very severe depression growing up. And I think that then that those sentiments like take on a really concrete body. I mean, the concrete body is that facility that we always feared going to until we realized the empowerment that existed through our organizing and our activism, and that we could voluntarily turn ourselves in and with the community behind us, be able to walk out.
So there are 1,500 people at this facility. Are they in barracks? Or how does it operate? How do they treat you?
The facility, there's about 8 buildings on the compound. 6 of them are residential. There's about, I want to say, 300 people per unit, roughly. And each unit has like about 5 pods, so 50 people per pod. And then in each pod, you have different 25 rooms so that there's 2 people per room. And I mean, I think there's definitely very little privacy. Mm-hmm. Like the toilet seat is kind of is exposed. And there's so much surveillance, like you're locked in indoors for all times except for meals and recreations for an hour a day, and for meals for about 30 minutes a day. So outside of that, you're basically in your pod at all times.
And you said that that's one of 3 CCR facilities that are all right in the same area.
Yeah,
so 1,500 in each.
So there's 4 other facilities in that corner of Eloy, Arizona.
Uh-huh.
And 3 of those are prisons. And then the 4th one that makes up that pot of 4 is the Eloy Immigration Detention Facility.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So leaving that facility when we were being driven out, it's very weird because it seems like there's 4 other, there's 3 more facilities.
But
like
those are private prisons.
Correct.
Run by CCR.
Yeah.
Arthur in Westerville, you're on the air with Marco Saavedra. Welcome.
Yes, ma'am. I wanted to make a couple of points. One of them is that while the overwhelming number of illegals in our country are Latinos, we have a lot of people from other places, too. There have to be 1 million, maybe 2 million Chinese in this country illegally. We're not going to be able to bus them back to China. We need to confront the fact that the only way to get a handle on the people that are here is to make them come forward. I would point out that part of the immigration reform bill that came out of the Senate is also for a biometric Social Security card. If we want to deal with possibility of voter fraud and make it a lot harder for criminals to hide out among us, and also want to make it a lot harder for people to get jobs once they come here illegally, that's an important part of the answer.
Okay.
And I'll let you get back to your gentleman.
All right. Thank you, Arthur.
Yes, ma'am.
Arthur brings up the issue that there's other people from other countries that are facing the same problems. How much unity is there among the different ethnic groups and the different nationality groups that are facing the deportation, a lot of for Eastern Europe, for instance? Again, China, they're from all over the place, Iran.
Correct. So I think it creates, there are definitely difficulties. And I think for us to build a movement for immigrant justice, we have to overcome those barriers, whether it be cultural or language or age. And at least when we were in our pod, we were mainly with men from the states of Gujarat and Punjab in India, men that were largely fleeing political asylum, political persecution, and were filing for asylum and had flown either to Central America and traversed all of Mexico and then checked in at the border asking for asylum. and there were 300, and there were 300 of them. And so over the 2 weeks that we were detained, we obviously became friends with a lot of them. And I think that because we were in such close quarters with one another that we couldn't avoid talking to one another or trying to talk to one another, that we were able to overcome those barriers. But I think it's a very real condition that exists, that the immigrant population obviously is not is anything but homogenous and has differences throughout.
You are, as I mentioned earlier, a poet and an artist, and an exhibit of your work opens on October 10th at the Ease Gallery. Tell us about how it relates to your activism, and tell us about, I was not able to see any of it, so describe what you do and how it relates to your work.
Correct. I'm largely a painter and a writer, and I think in many ways it has saved me as an outlet of expression. I don't want to describe it as an escape at all, because I think they're very real reflections of what I live. And I think elementally, I think it's like the basic human need to find some form of expression or creation, whether it be through bearing children or creating a piece of art or producing a piece of literature or gardening or cooking. Like, I think there's just an essential need for humans to create. And I think that that very real need is stripped away when you put bodies in detention and you survey them. We put them under constant watch for 24 hours a day and limit them in every way, and just limit like the human spirit to create in every way as well.
So you're a painter. What do your paintings depict?
I think it's a gamut of things. I think largely I kind of describe it as sensationalism, not in the journalistic way, but in a way of like trying to recreate the feeling, not the literal representation of what I'm trying to depict, whether it be a landscape or whether it be a still life or a portrait or something more abstract, but recreate that sensation, hopefully through color or through that medium, so that the viewer can then feel or attempt to feel approximate what I'm feeling. And I think that's the only way that we can find some unity, like with the gentleman that called in.
Well, Marco Saavedra, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Marco Saavedra, he's an artist and activist. He's in town. An exhibit of his work opens on October 10th at the Ease Gallery. For more information about that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about immigration reform, where it stands in Congress right now. We'll hear from two different sides of the coin of reform, some looking for an easing of the restrictions in some manner or extent, and the other looking for tougher restrictions. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to hear from two proponents of reform, but in different directions. Stephen Camerota is a director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, and Tamar Jacoby is the president and CEO of Immigration Works USA. And Stephen, you're with us now. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just to let people know, earlier this year, a bipartisan group of senators called the Gang of Eight put together a comprehensive immigration reform bill, the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act of 2013, passed the Senate in June. And for those in favor of reform, as in easing the way for new immigrants, it was a glimmer of hope. Although it was said to be dead on arrival in the Republican-controlled House, some have been busy working on several pieces of a reform plan there. We've brought together a couple reformers, as I said, one for liberalization of the laws and another for tightening the restrictions. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C., I said, is Stephen Camarota. He's director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, where they examine the consequences of legal and illegal immigration in the United States. And joining us in just a minute, Tamar Jacoby. She's president and CEO of Immigration Works USA, the National Federation of Small Business Owners working to advance better immigration law. Stephen, a major element in the House Democrats' plan is to strike from the Senate bill the border security measure that would add 700 miles of fencing and 20,000 border control agents across the U.S. or along the U.S.-Mexico border. Can any overhaul, in your opinion, succeed or proceed without that element or some facsimile of it?
Well, that was just a gimmick anyway. No one took it seriously when it was proposed. So if they strike it out, it doesn't matter. It would never be implemented. John McCain basically said it was a joke, and, you know, he supported it, was one of the architects. So, no, that wasn't really very important to the whole bill. I mean, the important things about the bill have to do with the other, what many people think are the weak enforcement provisions within the United States, the pulling back of enforcement in some areas, the amnesty for 10 to 12 million illegal immigrants, and then these very large increases both in permanent immigration, doubling it from 1 to 2 million a year, and then roughly doubling the number of guest workers coming in. That's the big parts of that bill. The border thing was just kind of a fig leaf that no one took seriously anyway. So I don't think that really matters whether that's in there. The big concerns are the amnesty, the doubling of permanent immigration, the doubling of guest workers, and then the weakness of the enforcement provisions.
Tamar Jacoby, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
I just mentioned that the House Democrats released a comprehensive immigration proposal yesterday, the intention being to keep pressure on the Republican-controlled House to move forward with an overhaul of the nation's border control laws. Do you think this sort of pressure will work, given that most believe the Democrat measure never will be taken up for a vote anyway?
Yeah, I think it's not even really pressure. It's more, to call it pressure is to kind of take it almost too seriously.
Okay.
What it is Democrats preparing, or some Democrats anyway, preparing a political game, which is that they're going to be, so they can go to Latinos and say, look, we introduced a perfectly reasonable bill and no Republicans would take us up on it. When in fact, it's not a perfectly reasonable bill in the House context. The House has said repeatedly they're not going to do the Senate bill. The House has said repeatedly they're not going to do a comprehensive bill, period, that they want to move piece by piece and take each piece on its own merits. I happen to be much more actually hopeful than many people that the House, you know, might do something. I mean, I think obviously people are very distracted right now by mm-hmm. what's going on, but I think it's quite possible, depending on how the dust settles on what's happening this week, that the House could still get to immigration, and that lots of House Republicans are prepared to vote for something, but it doesn't look like the Senate bill. And it's not the border. I don't often agree with Steve Camarota, but it's not actually the board. I mean, the House is going to need some very strong border piece, and it is going to need to be stronger than McCall's measure, which is what the Democrats have attached. Mm-hmm. But they're also going to they want a very different answer for the 11 million unauthorized immigrants in the country. I think they might go for the visas for workers, but they're going to have to cook their own soup, so mm-hmm. to speak. They're not just going to take the Senate soup.
Stephen Camarota, given what is going on in Congress and what's going on inside the Beltway right now, do you think that it bodes well for an ability to compromise on something like immigration reform after the dust settles? As Tamar put it, or does it bode ill for it? Is this making a situation that's going to be more difficult to find resolution and compromise?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, nobody knows for sure. I mean, you could argue that, look, all these bad feelings just make it hard to come to agreement on anything.
Right.
Or you might say, well, geez, you know, gosh, that we're fighting about everything else. Let's at least try to agree on this, right? So that's sort of the two competing dynamics. And then there are a million other considerations, right? Each party has to look at its base. Each party has different personalities. I think it's hard to say. The main reason why I think this kind of thing probably makes it less likely that they'll get a bill that that they pass, that then goes to conference and then comes back and passes, is time. Mm-hmm. These things tend to keep getting pushed back. Remember, when we started, everyone was saying, well, look, well, we can act by February. Then it says, well, at least we have something by March or April. Then it was June. And then it was like, well, look, by August. And then, well, by the end of September. In other words, everybody recognizes that the clock runs out very quickly in Congress, and this kind of bitter dispute probably makes it less likely, though there are lots of people who still want to pass something, even something like the Senate bill. But it's just hard to see how that happens, given the way the calendar works and given the distribution of opinion in the House.
See, what I would – the added complexity, I mean, I don't disagree, but the added complexity is House Republican leadership. You know, the real question here is House Republican leadership going to say to the rank and file, we're going to do this? And is that and partly, you know, one argument would say, well, they've used up their political capital on what's going on this week. Another argument would say, well, if Boehner comes out of this strong, which he might, he'd be in a position to say to folks, come on now, let's actually get something done and do immigration. Timing, you know, I don't know. I think we have more time than we think. I mean, I think, you know, if the House passed something this year, that would be a big step forward. You know, maybe we don't have to get it all done this year, but or even if the House passed something, you know, before February, I think, you know, we have a long time to go while before this Congress actually goes home. And if we made some progress in the House, you know, kind of in between now and, I don't know, early February, I think that could be, you know, useful.
Tamar, is the group that 30 Republicans in the House that they're talking about as the holdup in the budget negotiations, is that the same group of people that are going to tend to block reforms that you support?
It's not going to be exactly the same group, but there's going to be some overlap. But, you know, those people are they are also using up their political capital. So it's a very complicated dynamic up there. And, you know, people getting what you want at some times makes you stronger, but sometimes getting what you want when other people don't want it doesn't make you stronger. So you know, a lot's going to depend on what happens in this fight.
And Stephen Camarota, you want something to happen, too. I mean, both sides of this coin want something to come to fruition.
Right. I mean, I think we all agree that there's something wrong with the U.S. immigration system. I come down on the side of the debate that says that the Jordan Commission in the 1990s, mm-hmm. Which was headed by the late Barbara Jordan, a very important historical congresswoman, the first African-American elected from the South, and she headed a commission in the 90s that pointed out issues of labor market competition, assimilation, fiscal cost to taxpayers, and she suggested a more modest pace of immigration for the United States would make sense to facilitate their integration and so forth and take pressure particularly off the bottom end of the U.S. labor market, and I think she was right, and so I come down on that side. So this bill tends to move us in every way away from that. Not only do all the illegal immigrants get to stay, but the bigger issue is that it has these really large increases in future immigration, and even the enforcement provisions in the bill today are pretty weak. So just to give you one example, they require employers to verify the legal status of their workers, but they don't for 5 years. And secondly, they don't even have it ever apply to existing workers, only new workers. They could phase it in for existing workers, but they chose not to do that. So one of the centerpieces, everyone agrees, of enforcement is worksite enforcement, requiring the employers to verify the legal status of their workers. It's been illegal to hire an illegal since '86, mm-hmm. but this bill is very weak in that way. So in every way, the enforcement is weak, the expansion of immigration is weak, and it has this large amnesty. The amnesty, for me, is the least objectionable part of the bill, though there are lots of concerns about that amnesty.
We couldn't disagree more here. So just to put this in some light, I mean, I think Steve's dead wrong on how serious enforcement, what kind of enforcement is in the bill. The Senate bill, and this would be true of anything passed in the House as well, will require every business in America, before they hire any worker, whether that worker has a Latino name or an Asian name, or they're hiring their own child, world will require them to put that person through a government database and see if they're authorized to work and if they are who they are, say they are. Every business in America will have to use E-Verify.
Even small businesses.
Even small businesses, and even businesses that have never hired an immigrant and have no intention of hiring immigrants. So to say there's no worksite enforcement, it's just like crazy.
I didn't say there was none. I said it's quite weak.
But to say that, then to say, how radical is the Jordan Commission proposal? We now allow legally 1.2 million people in the country every year. The Jordan Commission proposes that we cut the legal limits to 250,000, less than a quarter.
That's completely wrong, Tamar.
You tell me what the number is, but the most recent poll of the public, Gallup poll tracks, and it's been tracking for years, whether people think immigration should be increased, decreased, or kept the same. And today it's 2-1 saying keep it the same or potentially even have some more, with only a third saying decrease it. That's a historic number in favor of immigration. The country is not arguing to go back to the Jordan Commission numbers.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Stephen, how is workplace enforcement as it stands in that measure weak? If everybody has to check an employee for determine whether or not they're documented or legal or not, what is it about it that's weak?
Yeah, it's 5 years, so you don't have to do it for 5 years.
Until
the bill passes.
Oh, okay.
And experience suggests that they'll keep pushing that back, saying, well, we're not quite ready. We can't expect
it. That's not true,
second,
actually.
It never applies to existing workers.
Okay.
So that it only applies. Now, there is significant churn in the U.S. labor. Millions of people lose jobs, gain jobs, enter the labor force each year. Nonetheless, it won't apply to anybody who just stays at their job. And if there are 7 or 8 million illegal immigrants currently working in the United States and more people come each year, none of those people who currently have a job would never affect them. So that's another problem. There's some other issues with the fact. So, for example, if you have a stolen identity, the way this thing is set up, it's not really going to catch you either, because what it's looking for is that a valid name, a valid social security number, and date of birth. If you've stolen someone else's, and thus it is technically valid, then you can beat the system as well. So even just asking people to check, you'd need some additional things in there that are not in this bill to make sure, but the fact that it doesn't get implemented for many years, and the fact that it never covers existing workers, are two of the biggest weaknesses. And the way it's structured, a large fraction of people could still work in the United States illegally.
So
you could correct those things, but they chose not to.
I want to just take a call real quick, Makara, in Columbus. Hi.
Hi. It's Makara here.
Hi.
Thanks for this discussion. I think this is a really, really vital discussion on the heart of our community. So my question mainly it's about the visa policy. So I was wondering, part of that immigration reform law, which is still going on right now, does it account to make the visa policy easy? Not really easy, but at least like best way to get the visa, because right now most of the people who are eligible to apply for visa, they have to wait for 2 years just to get the visa.
Okay.
And I think that's discourage the immigrants when they come here, discourage them to go back, because 85% of immigrants, they are willing actually to go back to their original country if we consider their visa policy in such an accessible way.
Okay. You want to see a reform in how the visa policy is administered.
Because right now it's not in favor, really.
Okay.
It just doesn't work the best.
All right.
There are a lot of if the Senate bill or something like it passes, there will be a lot of reforms in the visa policy. It will get easier for some people and harder for others. It's a very complicated system. There's literally every letter of the alphabet, different kind of visas for different kinds of people, and it will get easier for some and harder for some. The idea is to make it easier and to make it more workable. You know, it's the government that's part of the problem.
Let me, if I could just say
Stephen,
very briefly.
Stephen, absolutely.
The, there are two different issues. One is there are certain limits on how many people can come in some categories. Although the system is very generous under current law, over 1 million people are allowed to settle permanently in the United States each year. For some categories, like sponsoring a brother and from some countries, because there's per country limits for a category like that, you have to wait a while. So that's one type of wait. But I think what the caller is referring to is just the processing. Let's say you marry an American, an American citizen, and you want to bring that person in. That person is allowed to come into the United States without restriction, as long as you know they haven't committed a crime and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But the system is so currently overwhelmed with its workload that it takes some time, a lot of time to process that. Since this bill is going to hit an overwhelmed bureaucracy with a tsunami of additional work to process 10 or 12 million applications, to up all the categories, for example. So the likely outcome of that is that the waits will go long, the processing waits will go way up, because unless they just rubber stamp everything, which is a possibility, because they're going to have so many more applications.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I mean,
it depends on the funding, ultimately, something's funded, speaking of defunding and so forth. Makira, thank you for that call. We're talking about immigration reform. It is on the back burner, but it is on the closest burner, people say, to what they're
working on. That's a good metaphor. I like it. I'm gonna
the nearest burner.
Yeah.
They've got it on low in Washington.
It's still cooking.
Well, it is still cooking.
And there are folks behind the scenes in the House who are working. You know, Republican lawmakers who are working, and there's folks in leadership who want to move it forward. Mr. Cantor, for example, is working on his own version, his own answer for young people who were brought to the country illegally as children. It's called the DREAM Act in the Senate, and in past mm-hmm. years in the House, he's going to call it the Kids Act. So, you know, I think that's a very good metaphor, a back burner, but the near back burner.
We will be right back and continue our conversation when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR. News. Welcome back. We're talking about immigration reform with two people who want to see immigration reform. One, Tamar Jacoby, wants to see it liberalized and eased. And my other guest, Stephen Camarota, he would like to see the reform in the other direction, more restrictions and tightening up immigration rules and regulations. If you have a question or comment for them, you can join the conversation 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A lot of pro-reform in terms of easing the restrictions, Tamar, are very angry at the president right now because of the deportation issue. 1,000 people a day. I was just talking to somebody who is one of the nine dreamers who walked back through the border from Mexico to the United States and then were incarcerated for 15 days at one of the detention centers about that. How does that play into what you're talking about on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, so I take a kind of a different view. I mean, I come at this, a lot of the people who are asking for immigration reform or working for immigration reform come at it from kind of a rights perspective. I come at it from the perspective of what's good for America. And so I'm not really thinking liberalized isn't really the word I would use for what I'm looking for. I think what we want is a system that meets our needs so that brings more of the immigrants who we actually need and more immigrants coming in a legal way and fewer immigrants coming in an illegal way and who are immigrants who we don't particularly want or need. So I think we should pay more attention to supply and demand and people we need to work here, whether they're PhD scientists or farm workers doing work that Americans aren't applying to do. And we should have programs that allow those people to come. And the program should be more in sync with our real needs and who's going to make a stronger and better America. But it has to come with enforcement. And I think people should come legally, and we should open the front door, as Barbara Jordan actually, I think, used to say, open the front door and close the back door. Close down illegal immigration, but make legal immigration of people who would be great for America, let more of them come and let them come legally. But it has to come with enforcement. And it has to come with enforcement in the workplace, and it has to come with with enforcement and the border, and it, and you know, when the numbers we're letting in are more in line with really our needs, enforcement won't be so bad. You know, I mean, when there was prohibition, enforcement of liquor laws was really onerous. But once we had reasonable liquor laws, you know, nobody is upset about liquor licensing of bars. It's good protection. So, you know, I come with a different view, and I think that the border surge was kind of a, you know, the part of the Senate bill that the Democrats lopped off today was kind of a silly excess. I mean, they were going to spend money on stuff that we don't really need and isn't going to help. I mean, it was an unbelievable amount of money. I mean, it was you know, $40 billion. But I think you do need the place where, and here Steve Conrad and I probably agree, the place you need real enforcement is in the workplace. You need to be sure that when employers hire someone, they hire someone, they can find out whether that person is legal or not and authorized to work. I happen to think that the system we're building, you know, it's hard to build a big government system that works like that. I think we're on the road to building it. It doesn't work as well as it should yet, but they're doing what they can to fix it. And when they start to roll it out, it is going to take a few years to roll it out. It's not 5 years for everyone. Within the first few years, big companies will start to use it, and then it'll be medium-sized companies, and then it'll be smaller companies. That we're on the right track with that.
Stephen Camarota?
Well, here's the thing. It's been illegal since 1986 to hire an illegal immigrant. It wasn't until 1996 that they actually created a system to allow the employers to verify the information, which they're all gathering right now. Whenever you get a job, you fill that out.
Right.
So, and it wasn't until, and even now, they still haven't made it mandatory for everyone. They could do that tomorrow. They've chosen not to. Let me give you another example. 9 times Congress has required the creation of an entry-exit system. That is, that you, when temporary visitors come in, we record their arrival and their departure. This bill will be roughly the 10th time they've required. But each time the bureaucracy drags its feet, Congress pushes it back, says we can't do it. And what this bill does, which will likely never even be implemented, is only apply to the airports and the seaports, never the land ports, where most of the temporary visitors actually come through. That's another example of the tremendous weakness. If you were really serious about enforcing the law, you'd have to have an entry-exit system, which would not be easy at the land borders. Otherwise, how can you allow thousands or millions, I should say, temporary visitors and keep track to know whether the time limits have been altered? We're talking about tourists and business travelers, but also the big expansion of guest workers in this program. So the bottom line is that on enforcement, the things we could be doing right now, we're not. We keep delaying it. And the things that we've that Congress has already said should be done, we're still not doing. Anybody who believes that if this bill passes, the law will actually be enforced, you know, I've got swampland in Florida to sell.
I suppose anybody who believes that this bill will pass is living in la-la land anyways. There's going to be some kind of compromise ultimately. Let's go back to what Tamar said about the economic benefits and that she supports bringing people or allowing people into this country who can benefit this country. There was a Wall Street Journal editorial last June that sort of, I guess, some people say blew up the notion that new immigrants will be more of a burden than they're worth. It referred to the fact that the ratio of workers to retirees is falling fast, which means there's fewer and fewer workers to support me when I retire. I got in a decade or so, the ratio is expected to fall to 2.5 to 1. Immigrants arriving mostly during their working years without elderly relatives, most of them not eligible for Social Security if they are, and immigrants tend to have more children. What about that notion, Stephen Camarada? Do you see that? Can you visualize that for a future in the United States?
Right. It almost has no effect. This is very well studied among demographers. It's usually non-demographers who try to make this argument. There's a lot of both quantitative literature that looks at projections and then also looks retrospectively. If you take all the immigrants in the United States, say, retrospectively, have taken in and all their children, it's offset maybe 10 or 12% of all the aging that's gone on in the last 12 years. I mean, I should say 20 years. If you project out to the future, it looks like immigration can offset maybe 15%. The reason is the average immigrant right now arrives in his late 20s and has about 2.45, 2.4 children. It used to be more. Their fertility is falling faster than natives anyway, and they age like everyone else over time. So the average age of an immigrant right now, this may surprise you, is about 44 years. The average age of a native-born person is about 37 years. Not because the immigrants don't arrive young, but they age over time. As I say, it's well studied. Immigration can have a positive effect on aging, but it's very small. Now, the other problem in the U.S. economy is that working-age natives are not working. This is a long, complicated debate, but there certainly is good evidence that particularly for the less educated and the young is what's happening is the immigrants come in and are displacing them from the labor market.
Right now, we have about
60 million U.S. citizens of working age that are not working.
Usually the argument is that they won't work the jobs that the immigrants will work.
Let me give you one quick example of that. You hear that a lot saying in meat and poultry processing, right? That's a good example, right? Those jobs pay 45% less in real wages for the same exact job. Tomorrow we'll say it's a different job. I'm talking about the actual slaughter of the animals. They pay 45% less than they did in 1980, and those same employers then say no Americans will do those jobs.
It's not because of immigrants.
Wait, come on,
it's
don't interrupt me. You'll get your turn.
Let Stephen continue, and tomorrow.
There are an enormous number of jobs like that. Real wages in the farm sector are less now than they were in 1980. Real wages in meat and poultry processing are less. And real wages in many forms of construction are less, particularly things like drywall and roofing. They pay less than they used to. And relative to more educated workers, the decline has been even more dramatic. Yet those same employers are able to make the argument both in the media and Congress that they can't find anyone without ever mentioning that they're unwilling to pay even what they used to, let alone offer more competitive wages to attract Americans. It should not be the policy of the United States to keep wages low, particularly for the poorest Americans. The only way this kind of bill makes sense is if you think the poor in this country, the working poor, are overpaid.
Okay. Tamar?
So I apologize for interrupting.
No problem.
Some shows like it when you interrupt.
It's an emotional issue. I get it. But go ahead.
Okay,
thanks.
So here's the story. It sounds great. You know, oh, dear. This doesn't happen to be true. The reason that wages in meat processing and on farms have gone down is not because immigrants are in the U.S. working. It's because of competition from abroad and globalization. If you're not the guy who sells oranges or tomatoes or whatever is now competing with people who grow oranges and tomatoes right across the border or somewhere where it's easy to ship them here. He's not competing with just the guy down the road. And that has made it much tougher. And it's the same with meat processing. And so it's not because immigrants are taking the jobs that the wages are stagnant. It's because of this competition and globalization and in many industries, technology. Meanwhile, the good news is, that's the bad news, wages are stagnant or falling in some of these things. But the good news is Americans are getting much more educated. So in 1960 or 1950, more than half of the people in the U.S. labor force were high school dropouts. And they were eager to work in meat processing plants and construction and on farms. Today, less than 10% of the people in the U.S. workforce are high school dropouts, and they have no interest in working on a farm or a meat processing plant or doing construction, even when they lose their job in retail or in an office or somewhere better than that. And the problem is we still need workers to do some of those jobs, and if we don't actually have the workers to do those jobs, that actually means less work for those mid-skilled Americans. Because if you're a restaurant guy and you have a restaurant and you want to open a second one, but you can't because no one wants to be the busboy or the dishwasher, that means, you know, you can't hire any more skilled people. But if you find the right enough busboys and enough dishwashers and you open the second restaurant, you can hire a second chef and you can hire a bartender and you can have an architect design the second restaurant and you can send more laundry to the laundry every week. And that all creates more work for Americans, more skilled Americans to do the kind of work they're educated for.
Stephen, globalization has been, you know, a factor in the economics of this country and the downfall of the economics in this country for a long time now. That's well documented.
Right. And it's certainly also true that technology tends to exert downward pressure on the least educated. So not only globalization, but technology do. Mm-hmm. But then both those arguments says the last thing in the world you want to do is bringing even more workers to compete at the bottom end of the labor market because wages are already down. If technology is allowing you to substitute capital for labor, if you're having access to unskilled labor in foreign countries, and that's exerting it is increasing the effective supply of labor in the United States, then the last thing in the world you want to do is bring in more unskilled workers. And of course, this bill does bring in a lot of unskilled workers, but remember, it brings in a lot of skilled workers. And as we know, skilled workers in the United States haven't done that well in the last 10, 15 years either. We know, for example, in the technology and computer science and math, they call it STEM, science, technology, mm-hmm. engineering, and math. Of the people who are getting degrees in that field, half of them are not able to find even work in that field. Real wages for those STEM, those skilled people, let alone the people in the bottom who've done absolutely terrible, but even for those STEM folks, have not grown at all in the last decade. The idea, we're graduating about twice as many STEM workers as we actually have positions for them right now. Half of them aren't even finding jobs. Unemployment and non-work among new STEM graduates is at record highs. What this bill does is take the perspective of the business community and ignores all the government data on wages and employment rates and unemployment and basically substitutes that for the anecdote that employers tell about how they can't find workers and leaves off all that information about how many skilled or unskilled Americans aren't working, what are the wage trends, and just says we need more workers.
It's just a crazy argument. I mean, it's like saying the world is flat. Every country in the globe is now competing for the smartest, best, and brightest workers, the innovators. It's like in the 19th century, countries competed for coal and iron ore. Now they compete for the guys who can help them innovate and outcompete the next guy in a different country. And, you know, I don't know how Stephen counts the STEM workers who are unskilled, but just saying a lot of people have STEM degrees doesn't tell you that it's creating the right people for these companies to hire. Microsoft says it has 3,000 openings right now that it can't hire for. It's to say that we don't need skilled workers, innovative workers, and entrepreneurs, and that we shouldn't be opening the immigration system to attract more of those people, it just flies in the face of what every country in the globe is doing.
Most countries
can let all the other countries attract them, and we can sit here and close our gates, and you know we'll wake up in not very long. We won't have to wait very long to wake up and just find ourselves, you know, way behind.
Can I respond
briefly? Sure, Stephen. Yes, go ahead.
Look, again, the only way you can come to that conclusion is to ignore all the data the government collects on wages and employment. If you want to bring in 50,000 PhDs, some genuine Einsteins, no one objects. That's not what this bill does. This bill takes lots of people who have computer science degrees from Bangalore U and brings them into the United States. Some of our skilled categories, the biggest group of people who come in are physical therapists. We're not talking about PhDs in physics or even people with graduate degrees in engineering. That's not what this bill does. What it does is it gives companies like Microsoft lots of workers to keep wages of programmers down, even though we already know that wages of programmers for the last 12 years haven't gone up significantly at all. And it's also true for engineers and mathematicians in general. So you have to divorce yourself from the data the government's collecting on employment and wages and benefits and just listen to what the employers are saying. But they have such a strong vested interest to make the case they don't have workers, and then to pay lobbyists to make that argument for them as well, that's why this argument gets taken seriously, even though most Americans recognize one thing you can say about America today, we don't have a labor shortage, given the enormous number of working-age people of all skill levels not working.
Given the amount of dissonance between just the two of you and the complications, and it's not bad. You guys have done a great job, and I really appreciate it. But given that, you know, you're out front on this, and you represent pretty specific organizations. There are other organizations out there with other interests in this topic. Is this something that the United States Congress can wrap its brain around at this point?
So I would say, Stephen represents an extreme view, and that most of the country recognizes that we need more skilled workers, and that most Republican congressmen, I think, would be ready to vote for more skilled workers, and arguably, I think, for even more unskilled workers, as long as the employers have to try to hire Americans first.
Okay.
These employers, in all these programs, you have to try to hire Americans first, and it's much more expensive to hire a foreign worker.
Stephen Camarota?
Yeah, I think that one area where
we have just about 30 seconds. So
It's true. I agree that many in Congress are captive to businesses, and they will give them what they want if they can. The main reason this doesn't pass is most Americans don't want it. Most Americans want less immigration. We disagree on the polls. We won't run over that. But the bottom line is, especially when you tell them what's in this bill, the support for it is in the single digits. And that's the main reason
not
it doesn't
true.
Pass,
right.
Public dissatisfaction with it. Because I do agree that the lobbyists dominate on Capitol Hill.
Thank you so much, Stephen Camarota, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tamar Jacoby, President and CEO of Immigration Works USA, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.